Hello, everyone. This is Sasha Latipova for Trial Site News. This is my show, Due Diligence. Today, I have a very important guest and a very experienced legal researcher, Catherine Watt, and I highly recommend everyone to read her Substack, which is called Bailiwick News. And Catherine has compiled an encyclopedia, really, of knowledge of how our rights, constitutional rights, have been subverted. And really, if you want to understand what's going on today with the COVID pandemic, so-called pandemic, I highly recommend reading the Substack and understanding the legal deception and structure behind it. Today, welcome, Catherine. Would you like to introduce yourself and give some background?
Yeah, I should have prepared for that. I have a philosophy degree from Penn State. I worked as a reporter for a while for small newspapers, and then I got a paralegal certificate, and I worked for small law firms, mostly sole practitioners doing constitutional law and civil rights law and a lot of other types of things. And then because of the way the media landscape changed in the mid-90s, when blogs came along, I opened a first blog in 2005, and I've been doing independent reporting online since then. And then I started looking at the legal stuff for COVID when the lockdowns started in 2020.
Yeah, so when I found your Substack, I was blown away by the depth of the research, by the writing, the quality of everything, and the meticulous references that you've compiled. So it's a huge resource, very useful for everyone. But I stumbled on it. You have a post, and I think it's sort of overarching post that's called American Domestic Bioterrorism Program. So I wanted to kind of, as an introduction, would you explain to people why you call it that and how you arrived at that conclusion?
I call it that because I was trying to figure out from the beginning of 2020 onward, I was trying to figure out what was going on, especially at the local level and the state level, why the constitutional rights were not being protected by federal judges. There were some very early cases. There was one in Pennsylvania, and I think it was filed in May of 2020. And there was a good decision from a federal judge in September saying you can't do these shutdowns of people's businesses, you can't do these things at schools, you can't whatever. And then that was immediately sort of stopped by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. And that was confusing. And then in January 2022, that's this year, I heard a podcast with Todd Callender on Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vliet's show, Truth for Health, where he talked about the 2005 international health regulations put together by, it was an updated version, it turned out the World Health Organization had put together international health regulations. Sometimes they called them international sanitary regulations. They changed the name, but they started it in the 50s. And then they've updated it since. And in the 2005 version, they added in a whole lot more surveillance power and forced treatment powers and other things that the World Health Organization wanted the national governments to put into place through their own statutes and their own regulations and through their state level statutes and regulations. And after I heard the podcast, I went looking for the sources of what he had talked about. And then I started pulling on the threads and unraveled how they put it together they started long before 2005, but things really ramped up in the 2000s. And then it got rolled out like in its fullest form so far in January 2020.
Right. So, yeah, I was stunned by the long history of this. And So what was the earliest sort of relevant piece of law that you can trace that was changed in particular for this pandemic to occur?
I think the earliest one was the 1983 establishment of the Public Health Emergencies Program under the rubric of the Public Health Services Act, which was a 1944 law. But when Reagan and the Congress at the time put in the Public Health Emergencies section, that was the beginning of sort of concentrating much, much more power in the hands of the Health and Human Services Secretary whenever a public health emergency has been declared by the HHS Secretary. So it's a completely closed loop of once they declare it, they have all the power and they are the only one who can suspend their power because of the way they wrote the laws. To the extent, I'll say, to the extent that federal judges and Congress accept the premise that the executive branch can shut them out of everything after the announcement has been made.
So this sort of, you know, unconstitutional, I would say, law was put in place in the 80s, saying that this branch of government can usurp power pretty much at their own discretion. So what is public health emergency? How, you know, does it have to have some sort of concrete set of rules, data, any threshold that needs to be reached for a public health emergency to be declared? Or is it just something that they describe as one?
So far, I think it's just one that they describe as one. There may have been, at the beginning, no, it just said public health emergencies is a thing. It's basically like a parallel version of a national emergency. So if they declare a national emergency because of like a war or because of a natural disaster, that has all these cascade effects on other laws and other constitutional rights. And this just added another version of that to be public health emergencies as part of medicalizing it. And I think probably as part of making it harder for people to see that it was a government usurpation or a government tyranny effort, because people think, oh, it's about public health, it's about protecting us.
So this you know, it's now looking at this in retrospect, and of course I'm familiar with your writing in this particular piece, that's why I'm spending so much time on this particular question. It becomes clearer now why even, you know, all this massive propaganda campaign, even up in years to this, you know, so-called COVID pandemic, was focused on these, you know, sort of public health issues, but more, you know, they wanted to propagandize specifically viral pandemics.
Yes.
Through media, through Hollywood, Netflix shows, books, publications,
speech. And through test runs like test runs. SARS-1 in 2003, H1N1 in 2009. Yeah,
exactly. And then they would have these old stories about Ebola in Africa.
Yep.
Constantly barraging people with that idea. So they wanted that image of scary, scary virus that causes a pandemic that kills half of the world's population, which is total nonsense scientifically, I can assure you. But it's a figment of science fiction, plays on a lot of fears of people, imagination, lots of productions in Hollywood. Yeah. And then because they needed that to justify this, because at least in a, you know, national emergency, you can say, well, you can point to something concrete, a big earthquake, a big, some, you know, maybe somebody did attack us and a bomb exploded. You can point to concrete things. With this, it's more playing on imagination, on fears, on something invisible, an invisible threat that you can't identify, but it's so deadly and so stealthy. So that's how it all kind of ties together with the long history of this.
Yes. And it's way less destructive of infrastructure. Like it can destroy social, structures and economic structures without actually taking out like buildings and railroad tracks and factories with bombs. So it's for the people who want to do the takeover, they can keep all of the productive facilities and get rid of the people who might otherwise want a share in the products produced there. They did it with board games too. I don't know if you mentioned that in your list, but my kids have a board game called, I think it's called Pandemia or something. And the whole premise of the game is like you start off with rolling the dice or whatever, and it says that the pandemic has started in this country. The board is a map of the world, and then the goal of the people playing is to like control it with medications and various things. It's yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. I also recently watched, and I think they also played into people's beliefs and religious beliefs in particular. For example, I recently stumbled on a production by History Channel, which was talking about, the Book of Revelation, Apocalypse, and
Right.
they specifically used the disease and, the plagues and the disease part of it to fear monger like crazy. They got all these experts, I don't know where they got them from, to interview in this very over dramatic fashion, saying that there can be, and this was a few years before 2020,
Right.
saying that there could be this stealthy virus that imagine you're walking around without symptoms and
Yes.
then it spreads and then 500 million people dead. And, over dramatizing this nonsense, it exist like this in nature, but they're making this up and they're pretending like this is a big deal, real deal, very stealthy, very dangerous, so that the government needs to protect you from this.
Yes, and that piece about before you even have symptoms is super, super important because they came up with the term asymptomatic, and they also, I just found the other day, in a health and human services regulation, pre-communicable. That's even more than asymptomatic. It's before communicable, and they put that in as like this is a thing that we're going to try to keep track of so that if it's even in the just the pre-communicable stage, we can still quarantine people.
It's absolutely incredible. So they can quarantine you, so the government can take you away from your family, your children from your family, based on an unidentifiable pathogen of which you are not symptomatic and you have no ability to transmit it to anyone. So basically, just take you
For
away
no reason.
for no reason whatsoever. So that's kind of that's what I want to people to clearly understand. And then, so the second question I had is about this other transactional authority. And I think you covered it really, really well. And I will attach the document that you gave me to this video. But I want people to understand because not a lot of people familiar with this at all.
So I came across it because of Brooke Jackson's case. Brooke Jackson is the whistleblower who was working for Ventavia, who was a subcontractor to Pfizer under the contract Pfizer had with the Department of the Defense to produce 100 million doses of what they call a vaccine and distribute it through the DoD to all the people in the United States. And Brooke Jackson, as soon as she got to her trial site in, she had three in Texas, she noticed there were terrible problems with the clinical trials. And she reported it first to her bosses at Ventavia, then to people at Pfizer. Then she tried to file, I think, an anonymous hotline report to the FDA. And within hours of the FDA report, she was fired. And then she filed a False Claims Act case. Because her theory at that time was that Pfizer was defrauding the US government by falsely saying they were doing good clinical trials, and that the US government would want to know this because they would want to not spend money on a fraudulently produced product. And it turned out that that is not the case. The US government was in on the fraudulent clinical trials and in on the whole fraud entirely. And that sort of came out in Pfizer's April 2022 motion to dismiss. Because Brooke, when she filed her False Claims Act, she attached the statement of work, which was a contract that was supposed to govern how the clinical trials were done. And in its motion to dismiss, Pfizer attached another contract called an Other Transaction Authority, OTA contract, saying, in effect, no, we had no obligation to conduct valid clinical trials because the only goods and services we were providing to the US government according to this contract, are a large scale manufacturing demonstration for a prototype. Mm-hmm. So they kind of split off the clinical trials from the manufacturing and production side. And so I looked at that contract and had already sort of come to the conclusion that it was a joint fraud between Pfizer and the DoD. And this sort of corroborated that in Pfizer's own words. So the OTA is a separate contracting, purchasing framework that U.S. government agencies can enter into with private companies. And the report that I sent you is from KEI. And the title of it is Other Transaction Agreements, Government Contracts That Eliminate Protections for the Public on Pricing, Access, and Competition, including in connection with COVID-19 vaccines and treatments. Mm-hmm. And so it started in 1958, according to that report, through NASA, but it's since been expanded to, I think they said 11 agencies have it now, have this special authority that Congress has given them to enter into these contracts. And it suspends all kinds of oversight. That's the bottom line of what an OTA does. And so in my view, Pfizer is probably correct that under the terms of the OTA, they had no obligation to ever conduct a valid clinical trial. They could make the entire thing a fraud. They could make the entire thing seem to be real and submit actual data, but it didn't have to be good data. It didn't have to be in compliance with any of the regulations that otherwise govern clinical trials. And so that's why in the one piece I've done on it, I compared it to the emergency use authorization, because OTA did for the financial contracting side what EUA did to the drug regulation side. They both just took them out of the normal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is a structure by which the government can essentially waive for themselves all the normal rules and regulations for development approval of otherwise regulated products, such as pharmaceuticals.
Right.
And order that thing that now has no regulations attached to it.
Right.
From the private manufacturer who is otherwise would be regulated by those rules.
Yes.
So that's again, that needs to be understood very clearly. So, and when you said, you know, they order prototypes, is prototype defined? What is prototype?
Prototype is one of, I think it's one of the key words that makes it clearer that it's a bioweapon and not a drug. Well, it's a drug that is a bioweapon, basically. But prototype just has to do with it's a, I don't even know how to explain it. It's a product that doesn't have like other regulatory meanings. It's mm-hmm. Yeah, I should look into that more, but mm-hmm. like where in the statutes prototype is defined. But what it boils down to is it's a military product as part of a military project. It's mm-hmm. not a pharmaceutical project as part of a public health project. Yeah.
So yeah, I've been talking a lot about the fact that the DoD ordered all these prototypes and all these countermeasures,
and that they control it from the very beginning of the. Mm-hmm. I think you talked about that in the, or yeah,
yeah. So that's why, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, what is the proof that DoD controls it? How would you answer that question? You know, what does need to exist to show people the proof? Well, other than the documents that we're all pointing out to, but. Like, really, how do they control this whole production?
I mean, I think they control it because they control the, well, there's the things that you pointed out in the contract about the DoD has to be a participant on every single phone call, every single email, every single meeting that happens between Pfizer or its subcontractors or any of the pharmaceutical subcontractors and the FDA regulators, which means that DoD is in there directly controlling the decisions that FDA makes and the announcements mm-hmm. that FDA makes and the material that FDA is allowed to review or not review. And that plays into another piece of the puzzle that that showed up through Brooke Jackson's case, which is under the law, the HHS secretary is supposed to make his or her decisions about EUA products, about medical countermeasures, about security countermeasures, all these terms they came up with, which basically just mean bioweapons, but bioweapons packaged so that they look like medicine. They're supposed to make it on the basis of scientific data and evidence, comma, if available. And that if available is very, very important, because the DOD was in a position to make sure that no valid data would ever be made available to the FDA regulators, and to ensure that even without it, they would produce the authorizations and the approvals that the DOD required under the terms of the contract with Pfizer in order to go ahead with the manufacturing and the contracts and the hundreds of millions of dollars that they funneled to these companies. So the availability of data is a key part of how DOD controls not just the product itself, but also the information available to the regulators and to the HHS secretary. I don't think that gets them off the hook morally, because I think that the FDA and HHS officials were willing and knowing participants in it. And I think that can be shown. But it does explain the mechanism by which it was done, is done.
So, yeah, so that we need to spend a little more time on this. So the decision to, what is it legally called? Is it authorization, licensing, or is it just deployment of the countermeasures, is up to the sole authority of HHS secretary, who under Trump was Alex Azar, and now it's Javier Becerra. So yep. Those two individuals, you know, sequentially made yep. decisions about deployment of these countermeasures, prototypes, bioweapons
yes.
onto American public and the world.
Yes.
And that decision was based on available data, if available.
Yes. And it was based on available data about the products, and it was also based on available data about the known and potential risks of the actual thing that they were deploying the product against. So they got to decide unilaterally, basically as dictators, what is the level of threat that this SARS-CoV-2 poses to the population, and what are the acceptable risks and benefits calculations of the countermeasure deployed against that first SARS-CoV-2 thing. Mm-hmm. So it's like it is multi-layered.
So yeah, the enormity of this, I can't emphasize enough. This one
right.
person, Alex yep. Azar or Javier Becerra, decides for 300 million people
yep.
in the United States unilaterally how much threat COVID poses to them today
yes.
and in the future.
Yep.
And how safe and efficacious this product is for them specifically, individually, and for their children, their babies, their elderly, their now and in the future.
Yes.
So how insane that is just, you know, just blows my mind, but it is written in the US law.
Right. It's and, massive, and it's very hard to wrap your head around how massive it is.
Yeah. And I will put citations that Catherine provided under this video as well, so that people can check for themselves and read that language that we just cited. So another question I had, so, you know, before we go into the information management of this, so let's say, Alex, let's play back the scenario. Alex Azar is HHS. This thing starts unfolding. They're claiming it's, you know, super lethal, you know, next plague. Okay, so he decides, somebody shoves these things in front of him and says they're okay. Pfizer said so, FDA said so, DOD says so. He thinks, okay, they may be effective, and so let's deploy them.
Yeah.
So that's early, let's say early 2020. Now, 2 years later, we have 2 years worth of data mm-hmm. on both the transmission, local transmission of COVID, which is near zero everywhere. The effective
other treatments is another thing.
The deadliness of the injections, you know, there's a lot of adverse events. And now they're even admitting officially myocarditis is a thing. Uh-huh. A bunch of states said that, you know, such as Florida, we're not going to recommend it to children. Is this the available information that now Javier Becerra has to take into account? Or is it just, you know, he can pretend he never heard these things?
I think he can pretend he never heard these things. He could definitely pretend he never heard these things because he's been pretending that for 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
There is no, and that's where it gets into the amazing structural features Congress built into these things, where Congress not only put all the power into the HHS secretary's hand, they also eliminated their own oversight power. They eliminated, or they claimed to, this is written in the laws, they claimed that they have no power to overrule or like review his emergency declarations about their existing an emergency. They can't overrule his EUA declarations. They also put provisions that no federal judge can review those declarations. Once they're made, they're considered solely within agency discretion. So there's no judicial review, and eliminated states' power to take any course of action different from what the HHS secretary has said that they should do, which is called preemption. There's sections in these laws. I have it in my head, but I can't think of the name of it. That just make it so that there is no state authority to overrule HHS secretary. There is no congressional authority to overrule HHS secretary, and there is no judicial authority. Mm-hmm. And Congress did that, which raises the interesting, super interesting philosophical question of, with horrible implications, like how did they give away a power that they didn't have the power to give away? Like Congress does not have the power to dissolve itself. Congress does not have the power to dissolve the federal judiciary under the U.S. Constitution, but they did it to the extent that the federal judges are deferring to them and Congress is deferring to the HHS secretary, and the states, for the most part, with exceptions like Florida, are deferring and not challenging these things. They're just saying, whoop, that happened.
I guess we all, you know, you gave our power away.
I guess the Constitution's gone now, so whatever.
So we'll just continue collecting pensions and have a nice life and, you know, hope it will blow over, right?
I don't know if they hope it'll blow over. I think they're planning to make it more. Mm-hmm. More of them doing less and more of, I mean, because I think their goal is to, like, turn it all over to the World Health Organization and WEF and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's the game that they're playing.
Yeah.
But if they never had, you can't give away a power that wasn't yours to give away to begin with. And the power in our country is supposed to be in the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. There's supposed to be nobody that's above it. So to have Congress say, well, you know, never mind, is just super bizarre.
It's absolutely incredible. And I hope more people see this and understand what's happened. But, you know, just before we go into, you know, what's the next steps. So this just puts into perspective all the information warfare that was associated with this, because the key thing is available information, if available to one person.
If that person doesn't want to look at it, it's not available to him.
Yeah. If the person doesn't want to look at it, but at least, you know, somebody can challenge this was available through HHS. So that's why I've seen a lot of, you know, I've read now a lot of FOIA productions, including emails of FDA officials, including emails between CDC. And now we also know about the White House was colluding with the tech platforms.
Yes.
To, to in fact having an office. In fact, internally, while this was going on, I had a bet with my husband because I come from the Soviet Union. So I saw how, and this was even before the pandemic, I saw how quickly, you know, somebody would be banned from all platforms simultaneously,
yes.
Facebook
yes.
and Twitter and everything. And I kept telling him there is a central committee. Because
yeah.
you know, that's where I'm coming from.
You're like, I've seen this movie. Yes.
And he was like, no. They just make phone calls to each other. These are, you know, company, private companies. They're just, you know, sometimes they coordinate this stuff. And I'm like, no, there's this. And lo and behold.
Sure enough. There it is. Yep.
so, but my point is that they're actively all these, you know, so the emails, when I see them between the FDA officials, they're actively trying to prevent any information that contradicts this statement that, you know, COVID is the plague, it's going to kill billions of people, and we need these, you know, poorly designed, hastily made products on the market to prevent it. So whatever subverts that narrative, they're desperately sort of like managing fires to suppress that.
Yes.
And that becomes very, very obvious in these productions.
Yeah, I think I was just thinking this morning, because there are so many fronts on the war. I think the information one is the very, very, very primary, mm-hmm. primary one, because they need absolute control of the information to maintain the fear levels at the levels the fear has to be at to maintain all the other controls. And mm-hmm. as soon as people have information about who is doing what and what it is that they're doing, they get less afraid
mm-hmm.
because they understand it as like, oh, we're just being attacked. That's what this is. Instead mm-hmm. of the confusion and disorientation and social disconnection that they've been pulling off for a couple of years. So the information part is the top of the control pyramid in my view. And then they have that like reinforced with all these other things, with the regulations and the keeping the checks and balances and separation of powers from actually functioning. But to make all of that work, they have to keep everybody afraid, and to make everybody afraid, they have to keep control of the information.
Yeah, but it's you know, not working very well for them, is it? You know, because of the alternative media sort of expanded, and people became fed up, and after you've been lied for a while, it becomes obvious, and you know, so people become fed up. And I think the message is spreading, because we see, you know, the steep drop off in the vaccinations and very mm-hmm. low uptake in the new boosters and things of that nature. So I think as far as people becoming aware of they're being lied to, that's a good trend. I think we need to, you know, obviously explain more, you know, how the
right.
fraud is being committed. And well, another question I had is, you know, let's come back a little bit to the clinical trials, documentations, manufacturing documentation, any documentation that so far has been produced through FOIA. I know mm-hmm. some firms have been very successful in doing that, like Aaron Series, ICANN. They've produced a lot of materials, and especially the Pfizer clinical trial documents that I have been reviewing with a number of colleagues myself. How do we think about it? You know, if they never had to produce them or produce them to quality of the clinical trial, if it's not even a clinical trial, what do we think of them as?
I think of them as a performance art. They had to do them only insofar as they had to make people believe that real ones were happening. And they only had to make people believe that. If they had been as successful as they wanted to be, they would have done this short, sharp panic campaign, which is what they did in early 2020. They would have done these clinical trials in the shoddy, fraudulent way that they did them. But a lot of the people, I think, like at the level of Brooke Jackson and down, did not know that mm-hmm. what they were participating in was fake. They actually were getting injections. They actually were having symptoms or not having symptoms. They actually were reporting some of them to the clinical trial sites. The clinical trial sites were actually reporting some of the things that happened to the collection, like the sponsors. Because they needed to maintain that part of the fraud too. If people had known very early on, well, there's not really clinical trials at all, then many more people would not have taken it. The problem for them is that a lot of people didn't take it anyway, because a lot of people thought, first of all, people figured out, some of them, that the actual underlying SARS-CoV-2 was not as big of a threat as what they wanted everybody to believe. A lot of people had it, or what they believed it was, and then they were like, I have natural immunity. So then they had to knock down, well, there is no such thing as natural immunity anymore. There's no such thing as herd immunity anymore. A vaccine doesn't have to prevent you from getting something anymore. So they had to change all of these definitions and sort of keep the thing going. And the longer they tried to do that, the more evidence came out through these other, like you said, the alternative media channels, or people just knowing people who got sicker after they took it or whatever. But yeah, I think the whole point of it, and I don't, like, I say that partially because that's like how I understand the framework, but also I do think there's useful data in those things. It's just not complete. It's not up to the standards that it would need to be to actually, like, you know, far better than I do. It doesn't meet any of the things that a normal pharmaceutical regulatory process would have done. Mm-hmm. But it still is data. And that's why people like Naomi Wolf and Aaron Seary and Del Bigtree are able to have these crowdsourced analysis of the data and come up with information about what these things cause, which then helps other people try to reverse engineer what's actually in them to be causing this enormous range of neurological and reproductive and respiratory and all of the things that the injections cause. But yeah, the overarching purpose of them was to make it look like a valid pharmaceutical regulatory process had taken place when it had not.
Mm-hmm. Do they have, by law, do they have an obligation to people to disclose, you know, if you're issuing authorization for emergency use of the product, and you're issuing it under this other transactional authority under public health emergency, where, you know, it's a declaration by Alex Azar, do they have legal obligation to tell people that? Or is it okay under the law to lie and pretend that clinical trials are required for this?
I think that they've set it up so that it's okay because they've split them apart. They've split it apart as, this is a prototype, this is not a clinical trial. And then they said in the contracts, the clinical trials are actually being done by, they're not taxpayer funded. They're done by Pfizer itself as the sponsor. I don't know where, I mean, I think there are other contracts that would cover that. I have not seen them.
I haven't seen them either. I don't think they actually exist from the government.
I don't think they actually exist from the government either. And I don't know where they would exist. But I don't think they have, because they folded it under the EUA, because they folded it under the other transaction authority, I don't think they have any obligation to do anything as far
exactly.
as.
Exactly. So now that you said that, it became even clearer in my head that I've seen those contracts, and it was a very puzzling. I've seen the DoD contracts, and it was very puzzling way that they have carved out the clinical trial and anything that has to do with regulatory process from the money that they was being paid ostensibly for the large scale demonstration. Right. And now it makes all sense, because literally they're saying this clinical trial stuff and regulatory theater, this is a voluntary activity by Pfizer and FDA. They're just play acting together because they feel like it.
Yes.
What we're paying for is this other thing, other transactional authority prototype, military prototype. So I think that that's how they actually separated it.
Yeah.
So that, you know, and now these guys are performing theater here. But you're correct. This data, the data that's been produced is extremely important and valuable. And we've been able to get at this fraud through these productions. So that's extremely important for all of us.
Right. And also important, I think we touched on it, but you were asking about the, how do we know it's a bioweapon? How do we know DoD has complete control? Part of it is the fact that the people who have been able to actually get the vials either before injection or after, just using the residue, had to smuggle them from the chain of custody, because like you said, you talked about some of the documents that Warner Mendenhall found and other people where it shows it's considered a federal theft if you divert the product anywhere in the chain of custody before it goes into the person's arm. And the fact that those diversions have happened anyway, they also have produced important data about what's in them, which mm-hmm. you've written about like way more than I have.
Yes. The contract that Warner was mentioning, that's the contract between CDC and the vaccination centers. It's actually online.
Yes.
You know, people can read it. That specifies this whole language about federal property until it's injected. Oh, and this whole diversion language, which I found ridiculous. I think ostensibly they wrote it because, oh my God, these are so in such short supply. We need to vaccinate. As you said, they needed this.
Yeah.
Blitz as fast as possible, inject everyone because people will realize sooner or later they're being lied to. And so they were, okay, they're in such a short supply. You cannot divert them because, you know, every little vial counts. And, but here we are, a couple of years later, there are hundreds of millions of unused vials, hundreds of millions. So there's no shortage of them. And by the way, anything approved for market, formally approved by the FDA for market, and they claim fully approved, is, you know, I worked in clinical trials. You can order it through a licensed provider and do experiments with it, do studies with it as a third party independent researcher. It's totally valid and okay. And everybody does it like for competitive reasons and other things. So that was always positive. When I told my colleagues about it, they were like, what? No, we do this all the time, but with approved products, we do research. And I said, no, you can't. This is a federal property.
Two things about that. One is that you also have written about, and I have written about the international contracts, which specifically put in there that no third party independent testing mm-hmm. of the contents can be done. But the bigger picture of the combination of the adverse effects from the fraudulent trial that are helping people understand somewhat of what's in them and the analysis of the smuggled vials mm-hmm. before injection, which is also helping people figure out, gets to your bigger point that you make all the time, that nothing in the vials corresponds to what's on the label, so mm-hmm. that we actually have literally no idea what is in any of these things. And the only way we can get back to and reverse engineer and find out is mm-hmm. by looking at how does it damage people and what are the properties of it when you look at it under a microscope or whatever, like the, mm-hmm. So it's just that's such a big aspect of the thing that people think that they know what they've taken and they actually don't even know what they've taken.
No, and nobody knows what they've taken. And I also, I try to, you know, caution my colleagues who are taking as, you know, face valid what's written in, let's say, scientific journal about mRNA injections. Mm-hmm. And so they assume that it's produced as it's described in scientific literature.
Right.
Couldn't be farther from the truth. And then they make all kinds of assumptions. And I mean, oftentimes they're very, very well written papers and very, thoroughly researched. If you assume that this is the product, but
right.
what we're finding in reality, that's not the
you
product.
You can't make that assumption.
You can't make that assumption.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a huge problem because I also work with networks of physicians who are trying to understand how to treat patients. And
right.
without understanding what they got injured by, we can't really figure out how to treat them properly. I mean, we know certain things. We know that for the most part, it's poisoning of the blood. And, you know, there's particular characteristics that are exhibited in the blood. But that's also, you know, sort of the more convenient way to test people without, you know, huge equipment and expensive labs and so is a blood draw, right? That's all we can do so far and try to manage symptoms with various, you know, sort of trial error of simple supplements and generic products. But that's nowhere near where this needs to be. We need full disclosure. We need full understanding of what gets what's in those vials, who got injured by what, so that we can properly treat the vaccine injured.
Which is made even more complicated by the fact that it probably wasn't the same stuff in each of the vials. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the part where I think, I don't know if it was CDC or FDA or who, but somewhere in the US government shortly after the rollout said, you should not do antibody testing of people who have taken the shots, because that's not like, that's not going to show you anything that you're, would be useful to know. Mm-hmm. And maybe they even put like a financial thing, like we will not cover tests, but that, I think that helps reinforce the point that they didn't want people to be able to like do pre and post injection of their own blood work to mm-hmm. see what was in their blood before and what was in their blood after.
Yeah, and we there are only a handful of studies that I've seen where it just happened that, let's say, you know, there was a big Italian study, it just mm-hmm. happened so that the person was going to the clinic.
Yes, for blood, I saw that.
And there's only literally like 4 or 5 people.
I know, right. Yeah. Yeah, where they have the pre and post and they can look at them together and be like, oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But yes, those changes are quite characteristic that we're finding. And there's a lot of research going on there. I will be speaking more about it in the coming days. But, so before we leave off, I just wanted to, do you have any recommendations for people who are trying to prosecute cases or trying to complain about their vaccine injury or mistreatment or mandates? Hmm. Do you have any recommendations today?
Yeah, we have put together, it's still under construction, but there are useful things there called 5 Small Stones, 5 with the number 5 and then the word smallstones.com. It's an allusion to the David and Goliath Bible passage about a relatively smaller, weaker force using faith in God and 5 small stones to take out a much larger opponent. So the idea is that millions, hundreds of thousands of people, as many as possible, could be filing all kinds of self-filed things, because there are not enough attorneys to handle the amount of damage, death, and injury that has been done and is still being done. So we have some sort of one and done things where it's like a notice to a school district or a local government office or a business owner or whoever that what they're doing by enforcing any of these things is participating in war crimes and putting them on notice that you know that what they're doing is a war crime and that you want them to know that you know and that you are going to continue pursuing this as the months go on. There's another one that's an affidavit of noncompliance, which you can take to a county courthouse and file a new civil case called a civil miscellaneous case. And it basically just puts the court system, puts something into the judicial record, says, I understand what's happening and I am not complying with it. And the idea there is partly just to get it in the public record, partly to get people thinking through, like, where is my line? What is it going to take for me to decide that I'm not going to cross the line anymore? But partly to get it closer to the prosecutors at the county level and the sheriffs at the county level who have been completely AWOL. There's massive, massive crimes going on everywhere and they're just ignoring it for whatever reason, probably because they're afraid, but letting them know that there is a growing number of regular people who understand what's going on and want them to take action is a useful thing to do. So that, and then there's some other more complicated templates there about like medical malpractice and wrongful death to file at the state level. We're working on adding to that collection. And then the highest level of complexity are the federal cases that I write about mostly at my website, which get at the biggest crimes of treason and sedition and genocide. And so there's a bunch of different cases sort of in the development stage right now on those. And I keep posting about them as they unfold.
Wow. This is a lot of material, but I will link the site, 5 Small Stones, and I will link it to this video so that people can go and get, this is a self-help resource. So you can, file these complaints and, try to communicate with your local County
to
Pressing.
everybody.
Everybody, yeah. So
Yeah.
I think it takes all of us to push back on this.
Yeah.
Exactly, too, because...
And it gets back to the information piece being the primary battlefront that there is, because that's the place where the fear meets the population at the information thing. So the more people are putting out information that reduces fear,
Mm-hmm.
the better.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Catherine. Thank you for all your work.
Thank
you were
you.
doing, as one of our colleagues said, doing the most important legal work in the country today.
Thank
So,
you.
So this is definitely worthwhile to go and read about, and I'll post a bunch of links. So this will be on Trial Site News, but I will also post it on my channel, and hopefully we'll speak again, and I'll have another interview with you in the future.
Sounds good. Thank you. Thank you for everything you do.
Thanks.